gets colder. My eyes go thin as I get older. Piece in pieces, bloody and bruised. I feel so helpless and confused. 'Cause I hear screaming on the left, yelling on the right. I'm sitting in the middle trying to live my life. 'Cause I can't stop the warmth, shelter homeless.
Good afternoon. This is Evelyn Pringle. Welcome to Focus on the Facts. Today my guest is Martha Rosenberg. She's an award-winning investigative reporter and author. And we just finished an article together titled How Big Pharma is Cashing In on Alcohol and Drug Treatment. And we're going to talk about how Big Pharma has orchestrated this campaign to get into the rehab industry and come up with these drugs that they're drug and alcoholics and addicts with. And the problem is they're put on these drugs for life. So when we talk about alcoholics and addicts getting treatment and the cost of alcoholism and drug addiction, well, when you find out how much they're charging for these drugs, and like I said, they intend to keep these people on these drugs for life, we're going to find out that it's not much help to finances when they go to treatment for alcoholism or drug addiction these days. So I want to bring Martha on, and we'll start talking about it, and we'll talk about this article that we wrote. And it kind of outlines what Big Pharma has managed to do here. So are you there, Martha?
Yes, I am. Hi, Evelyn. How are you?
I'm fine. Happy to have you on.
Thank you.
You have written so many articles about the drug industry and food, and you're a health reporter. I mean, you've written, I can't even begin to count the articles you've written over the years. But you're probably the most knowledgeable person I know and reporter I know as far as Big Pharma schemes and in getting into business, and this one's a big one. I mean, this one is really, it bothers me because I'm a recovering alcoholic, and I was an AODA counselor for 13 years. So I know what harm they're doing now that they've infiltrated this industry.
Right, and you're really looking, you know, from the inside out, what a complete unethical scheme this is, which we can tell the listeners about. But I have to say, Evelyn, that you and I have both covered Big Pharma for a lot of years, but you are the only reporter that I've encountered who really wants to look at this rehab Big Pharma thing, which is very obvious and is very underreported.
Oh, yes. You know, I don't think I've noticed many investigative reporters for sure going out and investigating this. I mean, I have noticed stories in the media, like we've talked about in writing our article. You know, there's a lot of stories out there how these drugs are just causing another epidemic of addiction. And I did post on my Facebook page today all the different articles about this and how it's affecting, you know, everybody. But, yeah, I was very upset over this because of my background of being a recovering alcoholic with 31 years in sobriety. And, you know, I went to, basically when I sobered up, I went to AA for 2 months every day. And that kept me sober for 2 months, and it didn't cost me a penny. And
well,
back then, nobody took drugs or drank, you know, when they went to AA. When you went, you were an alcoholic, and you wanted to get sober. And now
I watched
this pharma has invested this industry and put everybody on psych drugs and speed for supposedly ADHD and everything, and has turned AA into a place that isn't that helpful anymore, because half the people that come in there are on drugs now, and they're loaded.
Well, I'd like to give the listeners a little background on this, because I think a lot of younger people especially, or people who aren't alcoholics, addicts, don't know kind of how the history of this stuff went. I've had a lot of this alcoholism and addiction in my family, so I know a lot about it. But it used to be, and I'm going to say even 10 years ago, certainly 20 years ago, that if you had a drug or alcohol problem, you could go to a rehab, and you know they would put you in the bed and they detox you and all this stuff. But really, the therapy was they would send you to 12-step meetings, which were free and which are free. And then some people never went to rehab, and they simply rolled into a church basement and found the 12 steps for free. So it's never ever been a Big Pharma thing, because the way that these self-help programs work is peer support, and you know, I would say spiritual. They're not certainly not religious, but there's never ever been a drug basis, because by the time you're an alcoholic or addict, drugs are your problem. They're not the solution.
Correct. Correct.
And then what's begun to happen, you know, of course, is that Big Pharma said, hey, here's a whole new revenue stream.
Yep, absolutely. And they manufactured these psychiatrists now, addiction psychiatrists, and it's a whole new front group like it always was for the psychiatric drugs. You know, now they've got into this, and they're into prescribing these drugs, and they teach doctors how to prescribe them. And then they don't do anything else for the alcoholic and addict, so they don't get treatment. All they get is prescribed these drugs. And it's such a racket that this one person told me that she paid $600 to go in and get a prescription for that Suboxone. And then after that, she had to pay another $100 a month to go in to get the refill. Well, the prescription cost $400 and some a month, and then the refill was $100 a month. And they don't intend to get you off these drugs. That's the big problem. They plan on keeping you on these for life. So there you have, she has $500 and some a month cost to get off of pain pills that she became addicted to after she had these surgeries.
You know, one thing I've always loved about working with you, Evelyn, is that you follow the money. And when you post the cost of these drugs, I'm always shocked at what Big Pharma thinks it can get from these drugs, because a lot of these drugs really cost more than most people's rent or mortgage. I mean, it's just obscene prices. And, of course, these people aren't paying out of pocket. They're either paying through insurance, which raises everyone's rates, or they're on Medicare, Medicaid, in which case we taxpayers are paying. And any way you look at it, it's unethical. Even if the drugs worked, which we're going to talk more about how they don't work, but even if they worked, there's no reason for them to cost, you know, like what was the one that we put in our article that's the injection, and it's something like $2,000 a month or something? Do you remember that one?
Unless you have a $500 a month coupon off that you can get on
right.
some site. And, of course, they put that up. You know, the drug companies have them put that up and to make it look like it's lower. But with $2,300 without the coupon and I think $1,300 and some with it, with a coupon or something like this. But that's a month. And I'm sure, and it's an injection, so you have to go to the doctor, so you're going to be paying a doctor's fee, too. Go ahead.
Yeah, and of course, the joke about all this is that you're replacing one drug with another. Let's say you're addicted to alcohol, you're addicted to opiates or whatever it might be, speed, meth, you know, so you're going to be on these new so-called treatment drugs forever as well. I mean, they're not, you know, they have no plan of getting you off them. So it's pharma elite, crowding the space that was once not monetized by Big Pharma. And few people have reported on it, maybe because they don't know how it used to be. I mean, at the rehabs and addiction was never a drug area. It was always mutual support. And a lot of, you know, of course, you want to detox from those drugs, but then you go on, you learn how to live life sober.
Exactly, exactly. And when I went to treatment, detox only took place when it was severe, and this was 31 years ago, and it was inpatient, and it was when it was severe, and it took place right in the hospital, and they might give you like Xanax or Valium, or something like this the first couple days, but then it got to where they didn't really give you that anymore unless, you know, your blood pressure was really high or you had seizures or something like this, then they would. But otherwise, when you came out of detox, even if you were on some drugs, you went off them when you went into treatment. You know, like when I was there, I can remember a few people were in detox, but and they were kind of messed up from these drugs. But then when after they detoxed, they came right out and went into treatment, and that was the end of those. But now, which has started, you know, years ago that I noticed, that now they're back to drugging and putting them, you know, they invent all these mental disorders, the psychiatry profession. And so now they're saying that alcoholics and addicts have anxiety disorder, have depression, have ADHD. So they got in there prescribing all these drugs to alcoholics and addicts which just opens the door because they're not getting off the other drugs and they're not going to stay off alcohol if they're kept high on these drugs in the meantime. Back when I went, I remember you couldn't even get an aspirin in treatment 31 years ago. I remember this girl cried afternoon for a Tylenol because she had a bad headache and you couldn't get anything. Which is how it should
be. And you wanted to be there because you knew you needed to. I have heard stories, and probably 31 years ago, maybe 21 years ago, but certainly it used to be the case that if you wanted help for your addiction or your alcoholism in New York, in a certain place in New York, you had to sit in a chair for 24 hours just to show you were serious. And
really?
Then people really, really wanted to not die from drugs and alcohol. And now, you know, it's like, well, instead of doing this, take this. It's a completely different model. It used to be there was a certain amount of suffering to get off that lifestyle, but then you were sober for life. And now there's not even a concept like that anymore. And they've tried to pretend like you have a lifelong disease. You have the disease of addiction, and the solution is a different drug. I mean, that's insane.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is, and it isn't working.
You know, I'd like to recommend any readers or listeners out there a really good book that it was a few years ago it was published, but I really recommend it. It's called Psychiatry Land, and it's written by Phil Senakin, who's a colleague of mine. And he told me, and this would be like 2009 or 2010, so, you know, he saw this early. He said, and this is a quote from an interview that he and I did, the insurance companies told the rehabs they would no longer pay for inpatient rehab for heroin, cocaine, or alcohol unless there was also another Axis One psychiatric disorder like bipolar disorder or major depression. And so literally that opened up this dual diagnosis bull in which you're not, you know, it's not really the alcohol. You're depressed, you're bipolar, you have adult ADHD. Well, I don't want to offend anyone who's been told that, and I'm sure their doctor believes it and they believe it, but it is absolutely a contrivance of Big Pharma.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, yes, it's a contrivance of them because it didn't exist. Like I said, 31 years ago, it didn't exist. And so now, you know, now just about everybody that goes into treatment is put on all these other drugs and things. And I can tell you, I was hooked into psychiatry field for probably 13 years before I got treatment for alcoholism.
When I went to
the psychiatrist, I was upset because, and I told him this, that I was, I would take this speed, and that would cause me to stay up for days. Well, then I couldn't get to sleep, so then I started drinking wine. And
right.
One morning I woke up, and I had drank a whole bottle of wine, and I left a suicide note. So
oh
that
my
scared
gosh.
Me. Yeah, yeah. So that was before I became even the worst alcoholic that I did become. And so I went to him. I told him this. You know, I was very honest with him that I knew
right.
what was happening. You know, I was high on speed for days, and then I crashed and wanted to go to sleep, so I drank that. But I didn't remember writing that note, so that really scared me. I had two little children at the time. And
oh.
so I ended up with a diagnosis of bipolar and was kept on drugs for 13 years while I became a horrible alcoholic, and I was honest with him about that, too. You know, I'm drinking a lot. I'm drinking, you know. Oh, are you? And switch the subject. Never once say, well, maybe you should cut down on drinking or maybe you should go to AA or something like this, you know. Just kept me on drugs until I finally became such a bad alcoholic that I did end up going to treatment myself and going to AA. And that's when I came off all those drugs. Well, now in hindsight and after I trained to be a counselor and everything, I know darn well I wasn't bipolar. I mean, you get hyper when you take speed and you crash and you get depressed and drink. But that's what got me the diagnosis of that.
Well,
but
you know,
now,
you know exactly then what, I mean, you know what you're talking about. You're not just an observer. You were in those rooms and you were told, or let's say mistold, that it was a mental illness when it was really addiction and alcoholism.
Absolutely, right from the start. I mean, immediately he should have told me you have to stop taking that speed and you shouldn't drink anymore, period.
You know, I don't know how many of your listeners remember when speed was a street drug. And you know, I certainly remember the, we had the Black Beauties, the White Crosses, the Preludens, the Dazoxin, and we called them Hearts, and it was a street drug. And
in the 70s,
now they're trying to pretend like, oh, you can't stay awake, so you have adult ADHD, and they're giving it like it's not a street drug, you know?
Exactly. And back in the 70s, I got it from a doctor, you know, when I could. And
right.
that doctor got
right.
busted because I found out he was ripping off Medicaid. The place, you'd go there and wait your turn, and you waited all day. The place would just be full, no matter how early you got there, and you waited your turn. And then he'd hand out the prescriptions right there in the office, too. And so then here, come to find out, I picked up the newspaper one day, and he was busted. Here, most of them people, I guess, were on Medicaid or something, so he was charging for that, you know, for all these Medicaid patients. And so it showed he was from Greece, and his partner was from Greece, too, his brother. He left this beautiful, beautiful house. They had a picture on the front page in Milwaukee Journal that he left us and went back to Greece, that he had ripped him off so bad. They shut him right down.
They stopped
prescribing speed then. And I said,
you know, I can remember a similar thing because I lived in New Orleans, and a lot of us, not me specifically, but people I knew and everything, we were dancing on Bourbon Street. And so, mm-hmm. you know, first of all, you can't be fat because, you know, you're a dancer, but secondly, you needed that energy. So mm-hmm. we'd all go to the doctors that sold the prescriptions, and we were like, we need the speed because we need the energy and we don't want to eat too much. And they just sell those prescriptions. And now they act like, oh, this is such a serious drug. No, it isn't. It's a street drug.
Yes, it is. And after, on my own, the different times I would quit drinking on my own a few times over
right.
the years. But if I would go back and take speed, I would end up drinking again because I'd be hyper and I couldn't sleep. And so I'd drink again. So I see how dangerous this is. It was even dangerous when it started coming out because I remembered that I said had they not quit prescribing it, I probably never would have went on it because I liked the energy and I liked, you know, how it made me feel. And so I was glad looking back that they quit prescribing it because the street stuff would make me sick. You know, half of it was no good. And so anyhow, when they started prescribing it, it was like, this is bad for everybody. I said, somebody like me that liked it so much. They got these quizzes online telling you how to get ADHD. They have lists of doctors, go mm-hmm. to them, they have a coupon mm-hmm. for money off on the drug. They're just directing you to go right there. And I thought, this is horrible for us recovery addicts and stuff too.
Oh, it's terrible. And like you say, it drives the alcohol and it drives the sleeping pills because it's that... You know, your rhythms are going to be all off. Can you talk a little, Evelyn, about how you became a drug counselor and what you learned? And you know, because you've really been in the trenches here.
Yeah. I had to take all these classes, and then I had to do a training for a year at this recovery place. And it was down in Oshkosh, so it was like 56 miles each day, so it was kind of a long haul. But I had to train for that, and then two nights a week I had to stay till 9 at night. And for a year solid, and then I trained for another 7 months at another agency, and then I got hired there, and then shortly after that, I started my own treatment agency. And I made it different from everything else. I made it so nobody who came got turned away, whether they had insurance or not. I provided a sliding fee scale, and I made up my mind that nobody would have to go without treatment. If they came and wanted treatment, that I would take them. And I ended up with a lot of people from other treatment centers because... Conveniently, back then even, this would have been in like 1990 or so, 92, that if with the insurance companies, with the hospitals, they had such high prices and stuff that when it got to a certain amount, their treatment, they knew that insurance wasn't going to pay anymore. So they would conveniently find a reason to kick those people out of treatment.
Wow.
And they would end up at my door, and I would come and I'd show them and I'd tell them, you really didn't do anything wrong. They'd kick them out of aftercare saying, well, you missed the AV meeting we told you to go to. And here they completed the whole treatment and they're in aftercare. And they'd kick them out, and I'd take them and show them. I'll show you why they kicked you out. It's right here. Your insurance is not covering anymore. And they kicked you out of treatment because they weren't guaranteed they were going to get your money. And word got around that I would take people, so I would explain to each one of them, show them their insurance form. This is why you got kicked out. It wasn't that you were back.
That is so radical because, you know, how can saving a life, because we know addiction and alcoholism usually ends in death, how can that be a money thing? I mean, that's
what it is.
What society should be based on, you know?
Right.
That is amazing.
After I opened my own agency, I ended up going, you know, I had meetings where I had close friends. You know, I mean, I would go every single week to certain meetings, and you develop close friendships. And I remember going to this one meeting, I was close to everybody, and I started crying, and I told them I was so discouraged and upset that I thought, you know, recovery was all about people wanting to help and everything, and I found out it is nothing more than a money-making scheme, that I was so disappointed after I opened my own agency. And they, you know, it was just like any other industry, but now it's worse. I mean,
I would tell anybody who's listening who can't stop drinking or can't stop using a drug or even can't stop eating, go to a 12-step meeting. You will be loved,
yes.
And it is totally free, and nobody will ever reveal your identity. And it's a radical medical concept because it's not based on money. It's not based on big pharma. It's not even based on professionalism. It's based on people helping each other out of love and gratitude.
Right.
And it's not a religion.
No. You know that. And this is big pharma and the psychiatrists and stuff spreading this stuff around. I'm seeing this more and more where people are saying it's a religious cult and all this. I'll tell you what. I had an aversion to religion when I went in there. And if they would have been pushing religion, I probably never would have went back. They did not. You know, I think the word God was in the 12 steps. And I made up my mind, but they weren't really pushing that on me, that I could ignore that word at the time, you know. But when I hear people say that it's a religious cult and everything, I really get angry because that is so untrue.
Well, it's totally untrue. In fact, they even have atheist groups. Remember the Quad A's, you know, atheist alcohol. I mean, you don't even have to have a religion at all. And that's just a lie. But, you know, what it is it's just a free self-help the program that what's so wonderful is that it's got the anonymity. So, you know, people who, you know, maybe they have a high stature in society, they can go in there. Nobody's going to, you know, blow their cover, so to speak. And you know, so that it's just a radical idea. You know, I live here in Chicago, and I think it was yesterday, on the front page of the Chicago Tribune, they had a really radical story about a recovering heroin addict. I don't remember his name, but anybody could go to the Chicago Trib. And he is just helping everyone, just like you were saying with your program. Regardless of money, regardless of anything, he's just helping anybody because he has the answer to getting off the heroin, which is largely the 12 steps, though you probably need detox. And the answer is free, and he's helping anyone for free. And you know, it's just a radical concept. And he's against, which you and I wrote in our article, this idea of replacing the drug with another expensive drug because that's antithetical to recovery.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, and he, and I think he's one of those, too, that makes sure that everybody gets treatment.
I think so, too. I mean, it's just a radical,
article.
You know, idea that why should something like this be, you know, pardon my French, but it's really being pimped. It really is. And, you know, you talked about front groups, and you and I have written a lot about that, and I hope we keep doing it because I sometimes think that we're tilting it at windmills here. But, you know, there's these new so-called medical addiction groups, okay? And one of them is called the American Society of Addiction Medicine. And the other one is called the American Academy of Addiction Psychiatry. And you and I looked at their records and did a little research, and they're absolutely funded by Big Pharma, and they're funded to sell pharma drugs. They have nothing. They don't want to get you help you with your addiction. They want to sell addiction drugs. And the American Society of Addiction Medicine took over $47,000 from Pfizer in 2013, 14, and 15, and that's just one drug company, and I would just guess there are probably like five more, okay? And then the other one, the American Academy of Addiction Psychiatry, I looked up their board members, and at least six of them had big links to Big Pharma, and three of them are actually on Big Pharma's speaker boards. So if you're going around the country telling everyone how great your drugs are, how are you, you know, that is such a conflict of interest that, you know, I hope nobody gets fooled by it, that's all. And then And then can you tell them about the other one, the National Alliance of Advocates for View, how do you say it, View for...
Suboxone. Yeah,
right, treatment.
Suboxone is the, yeah. Yeah, that came out right with the name in their title. They're just pushing that all over the place. And anybody, and one of their goals, those front groups, is if there's articles out there or, you know, papers saying the drug is bad or anything, is to get out there and write articles of their own and things like this.
Mm-hmm,
and if, say, if they got brought to the FDA, if there was problems with the drug or something, they would go, and, as this front group, you know, they would go and testify to how good the drug is and how well it's doing and round up some people to bring us patients that are doing real. They do these kind of things. And that one about the addiction psychiatry, I think it was, I found where the maker of Suboxone gave him $100,000 in membership dues 1 year.
Yes. And that's
year.
In our article, yes.
Yes.
So I mean, come on, that's a huge, it's like, to me, it's just really shocking that such high-level financial conflicts of interest are ignored, and they want to act like this is a medical group. This is a pharma group, pure and simple.
Yes, yes.
And another thing I always like to talk about is NAMI and Active Minds. NAMI is the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and it has been investigated by Congress. Most of its money comes from Big Pharma, and, you know, you talk about rounding up patients. It rounds up patients, and I'm not saying these patients don't have whatever the illness might be, but what I am saying is that these patients are used by Big Pharma to get high-level expensive drugs approved that loot our tax dollars. And NAMI is a very, it's probably one of the least ethical groups in the nation because it pimps patients, it pimps our tax dollars, and the worst thing it does is it sells mental illness. And what NAMI has done, and a group that's very similar called Active Minds, which is on the college campuses, is they're trying to cast addiction, like alcoholism and drug addiction, as mental illness, okay?
Right.
Is just like we're saying with the recovery and the drugs. They're not mental illness. They're actually selling the idea like being, you know, you are mentally ill and it's very cool to be mentally ill because, you know, it's not your fault and it's not a stigma and here's a drug you can take and it's not your fault. Well, it's also not mental illness, you know?
Right. Yes, that's what they do, and they keep you in this mode too. That, you know, that you're mentally ill for life, and staying on the drugs, all these drugs for life. And yes, the large percentage of these drugs are paid for with taxpayers' money, and that's why Congress investigated. You know, Senator Grassley there investigated it so thoroughly, and I helped them with that. And yeah, we investigated. I told him he was doing good with looking into one group, but he better look at all the others. And I went and found out all the drugs that were given to all these other groups, and they were just as dirty with drug money. I mean, it was like at least 3/4 of their money came from the drug companies. And that's all they were doing, is selling this notion that you're mentally ill and you're mentally ill for life, and come and group with us, you know, and we'll have meetings and we'll talk about everything, and we'll just stay mentally ill for life and stay on all these drugs. And so it didn't do any good, though, after we discovered all that and published it online and everything. Then front groups just went to publishing their budgets on their website, and anybody could go look at them. And then the drug companies didn't quit giving them as much money. They just kept right on. It's so blatant now that they just do this right out in the open and get away with it. And like you said, those doctors are on their speakers' bureaus and stuff. I seen one doctor, when they tracked him down, that he made $750 for a speech. And the drug companies, it was a Suboxone doctor prescribing
right.
that. He had made 750 speeches for them.
You know, I believe these
750
people...
a speech, 75 speeches in a very short time. So look at the money. What does that come out to? I don't even know.
You know,
Evelyn,
when you tell me something like that, I actually believe these people should be in jail because they're not only looting our tax dollars and heightening our insurance, but they're also harming people and they're lying and they're abusing their Hippocratic oath. I mean, it's so low. And you know, one thing that just happened a few months ago was the new FDA commissioner, which is this Robert Califf, or Califf, I don't even know how you say it, but he had 23 links to Big Pharma, and no, just as you're saying, nobody cared. It used to be these links that we're talking, these financial links we're talking about, they had to hide them, And now they don't even hide them.
No. 10 years ago,
it's like there was a time,
Dr.
Kellett was on the board of Genentech and another pharma company, on the board of a big pharma company, and he's now commissioner of the agency that regulates big pharma. I mean, what? It's almost like the conflict of interest doesn't even matter anymore.
No. When I first started reporting on these drug scandals and device scandals, I went and investigated, when they'd have their advisory committee meetings and how many people would be on those meetings that they had were tied to the drugs or vaccines or whatever that they were pushing, And back then, I think it was Senator Grassley then, too, was investigating that. Or was it, I forget, one of the senators was. Was really, crapping about this, that how can this be? And I wrote articles about it and everything. Yes, it was blatant conflict of interest, and at that time, Congress wanted to get rid of that. But now, it's all the time.
And then there's another thing we haven't even talked about yet, which is this so-called opiate epidemic. It is an opiate epidemic, for sure, of OxyContin.
And what is it caused by?
But what we know is, that you and I know, is that it wasn't, contrary to what Trump says, it wasn't caused by Mexico. It was caused by Big Pharma. The very makers of these opiates paid doctors to change the guidelines. I've written about it. You've written about it. Everybody's written about it. And what they did is they got the people on the opiates hooked because narcotics are by definition addictive. And then they had this whole pool of patients for the drugs we're talking about now, the addiction drugs. So it's like they played both sides of the street. They caused the opiate epidemic. And one group that I reported on not too long ago was like a geriatric medicine association. And they literally wrote in their guidelines, Evelyn, the first drug you should give your elderly patients is not the NSAIDs, like the Tylenol. The first drug you should give them is opiates. They literally put that in their guideline. And then, everybody's addicted. How did that happen?
Right. Well, the elderly are all addicted to them now. And that's from the doctors and those drug companies getting them to prescribe those drugs. Wasn't it Purdue Pharma that, was OxyContin? When they came out with that, they said it wasn't addictive. And they got everybody prescribing it. And, that led to the heroin addiction, the uplift in heroin addiction. Everybody was
addicted
to that.
Completely caused it. What Big Pharma did, Purdue and the other makers of the opiates, is they had a huge campaign that lower back pain justified opiates. Okay, so first you have lower back pain, now you're an opiate addict and maybe going to go on to heroin. I mean, it's criminal. And then they're like, how come is everybody so hooked on, obviously when they can't get the drugs or regulations, like you talk about, patients are dropped from their programs or something, and then they're going to be on heroin. And the whole thing was preventable, and I believe the whole thing was foreseeable. Anybody could see what was going to happen. There was a reason that narcotics were so hard to come by up until OxyContin.
Right. And now, they go back and forth. I mean, I read articles all the time how the FDA is cracking down more on prescribing pain pills and stuff. But then the next time, they're backing this, these drugs to addicts and alcoholics, full-fledged. They're backing this. In fact, they even invested our tax dollars into trials and stuff. I mean, millions upon millions. I think like 400 and some million into getting that drug approved, that Suboxone.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. FDA has played both sides of the street with this because, of its conflict of interest. And I remember, I think on the same day that they tightened guidelines on like Vicodin or Percocet or one of those, on the very same day they approved a new, a son of OxyContin drug that was even worse. And so it's like they're playing both sides of the street for sure. And it's ironic that, that they would name this Robert Califf to be FDA commissioner when our whole opiate epidemic was basically caused by pharma companies. And now we're handing the agency over to Big Pharma.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit, Evelyn, about more how the government agencies have supported these front groups?
Well, that's the thing. They, like I said, they're the ones that got behind this, approving these drugs for alcoholics and addicts. And when I went to their webpage and I read all about how they describe it now, and of course, you know, they had the help of the American Psychiatric Association putting out their last DSM Bible for
right,
billing
right.
purposes, that's all it's for, of expanding the alcoholism definition to now putting down the alcohol abuse too, you know, and that opens the door for this because now the FDA on their webpage, when they're talking about these drugs, they make it sound like you're always going to relapse if you're an alcoholic, and this gets me so angry. And that's why these drugs are helpful. You know,
right,
but it's
right.
inevitable.
Well, you know, really, Evelyn, they being the APA, the American Psychiatric Association, is extremely linked to Big Pharma, and it doesn't hide it. And
no,
what they've done
no.
over the years, since I've been reporting this and you've been reporting this, is they've actually changed definitions of diseases in order to sell drugs. I mean, they really have. And one example is depression. I mean, I can remember when depression wasn't a self-limiting disorder. It was unpleasant. It was terrible, but it wouldn't go on forever. And then they came up with this lifelong depression so they could sell the lifelong SSRIs, which don't even work after a year. Okay, so that was one thing. But then they've clearly changed the definition of addiction. And, you know, it's
yes.
like you have a lifelong disease called addiction. No, you don't. You're a victim. If you're an alcoholic, yeah, you can never drink again. But if you're an opiate addict, you are probably inappropriately given opiates by a doctor, you know, because
right.
they're going to addict anyone, you know?
Correct.
And
well,
to pretend that this is some lifelong disease, you know, what we talk about these different government groups, the Center for Abuse, Center for Substance Abuse Treatment, Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, and National Institute on Drug Abuse. And those are just four government groups that have supported these front groups selling drugs. But NIDA, National Institute on Drug Abuse, is like the one that I have the most trouble with because
uh-huh.
its director does not even understand drug addiction, even though you'd think the director of such an institute would. And she literally has been like cutting up primates trying to find the mental cause of addiction. You know, and it's like anybody who's in the cause of opiate addiction is narcotics are addictive, duh, okay? But the
yeah.
cause of like alcohol addiction, we know that we don't, there is no medical or brain cause. We know that. We know the solution for anybody that gets to the doors is the 12-step programs. So, you know, there is no mental cause for it. And she was, up until recently, and probably still doing it, seeking a vaccine for alcoholism and drug addiction. And anybody who's had this in their family or been around recovery knows that that's just insane. And how can you direct an institute when you're that stupid?
Yeah, right. I don't think anybody should head an institute like that unless they're an alcoholic themselves, I'm telling you, because you can't know. Yeah, they're sitting there guessing, and now the thought coming up with the vaccine, now that would be filled with poisons in itself, and so that would be another thing that they're just going to damage people with. But, yeah, that's so ridiculous, but I hate it that they're downplaying the importance of staying sober because alcoholics are always
mm-hmm.
looking for an easier, softer way, you
mm-hmm.
know, to get around this. And when they say right on their page, on the FDA pages, that, you know, relapse is just about certain and stuff. And you know, this is the thing that helped me stay sober, you know, that no, it isn't certain, and no, you can't relapse, you know. If you do, it'll be harder the next time and these kind of things. And they make it sound routine, like this is just going to happen. Well, that's not good because when you're sitting there telling alcoholics, well, if you relapse every now and again, you know, that's just a disease, you know, that just happens. Well, what does that do for the family and relationships when the family and stuff always have to sit there worrying that the counselor or the psychiatrist has told them, well, you probably will relapse again. So then they got to sit there worrying all the time that this is going to happen again, and, you know, how some of us get when we're alcoholic, how obnoxious and, irrational and, you know, boisterous and everything. The family has to look forward to that. They can't look forward to like we always had it, that, no, we are not going to drink again. If we do, you know, that's very bad and we don't want to. But they're getting permission.
You know, I had not thought of it. I didn't realize that. Now, you personally, I mean, you don't mind talking about your own experience. You never did relapse, did you?
I did one time in my seventh month.
Mm-hmm.
It was after a real traumatic thing in my life happened and stuff. And I, looking back, I can see what happened. But I did for one day. Yeah. And I'll tell you, I was in recovery then. And once you're in recovery, in good recovery, I mean, you get values and morals and things like this. I never felt so guilty in my life over anything the next day. You know, and here I went to the store with my two cousins, and we were going to lock ourselves up in our apartments. Nobody'd know, and nobody'd answer the door. We each bought enough beer we're going to drink, and that was just it, just one day. But then in the morning, I woke up, and it was, oh, my God. And my one cousin was there. I said, oh, go over to Baker Boy and get a 12-pack. I couldn't even lift my head again, just like 7 years earlier when I quit drinking. And then he came back, and I was sitting there, and here I was supposed to be helping chair an NA dance that night and stuff. And I'm sitting there thinking I'd open that beer and start drinking it. And I was all of a sudden, I said, oh, just take this and take the bus and go home. Take this beer. And then I got out of it. But I didn't talk at AA for 2 weeks. I felt so guilty and ashamed that I had done that. You know, but the way they're making it now, that wouldn't be a big thing. You know, well, so
it's a huge thing. I mean, the whole program is designed for that to never, ever happen, because we have each other, we have sponsors. That's terrible that they give permission to relapse because they want to sell their drugs. It is true that if you're an alcoholic, you'll always be an alcoholic. That is absolutely true. But it doesn't mean you always need to be on some drug for life.
Right. And this is the thing. And like we're talking about that drug for alcoholism, that, you know, $1,300 with the coupon, that's every month. And then you got to go to the doctor and pay that fee every month. You know, and this gal that you know, talked to me for this article that we wrote, well,
right.
She said she had to pay that $600, you know, to get into the program.
Right,
and then
right.
Her prescription was $412, and she had to go every month to get the refill, you know, refill, and he charged $100 for that. Well, then she didn't know it when he put her on it. She didn't tell him. He didn't have any plan for her to get off that drug. So when she found out, and her insurance wasn't paying this, she's paying this out of her own pocket. It was like she finally decided she wanted to try to taper off herself then. So she started, and so she said she didn't need to go for the appointment because she didn't need a prescription. So then they called her and asked her how she was doing and everything. She said good, but she would need to come in for an appointment because she was tapering off the drugs, so she didn't need another refill yet. And they told her, oh, no, you have to stay in the program and come in for your appointments or you can't be in the program. So it was like you keep coming in and paying that $100 or else, you know, you're out of our program. So she never went back, and she went into withdrawal so bad. I mean, everything I've learned about Suboxone, the withdrawal is 10 times worse than the pain pills. I mean,
I've heard that too. And what an irony when that was developed to be the solution, and it's now a new problem. And like we say in our article, which by the way is going to be an alternate, it also leads people to opiates. So it's a gateway.
Exactly, exactly, because then you have to get in one of these programs to get that drug again. So if you really, when they're in such extreme withdrawal, they go back to using pain pills.
Yeah, and
because
who wouldn't?
You have to
I mean,
get in this
we're
program.
Only human. Yeah, I'm surprised that more people haven't called that this is making the problem worse, not better. Can you talk a little bit about the psychiatrist that you interviewed, Dr. Stefan? I don't know how to pronounce his last name, but you know who I'm talking about?
Yeah. The same thing. He says no drugs. And he's altogether against, you know, this diagnosing people mentally ill that
mm-hmm.
are addicts and alcoholics, too. He's dead
mm-hmm.
against that because he goes in and describes all the different things these drugs can do to you, the harm they can do to you. You know, when they put you on, and they don't work. None of them, the psychiatric drugs, they don't. And then the trial showed that, but the FDA let that go by. I mean, how many investigative journalists and researchers have dug into those data on those drugs that they never worked? And the trial showed it, but the FDA hid that and let them get away with this. But I don't know how many people realize this, that to get a drug approved, all you have to do is come up with a 6-week trial of so many patients and all you have to do is come up with two where that drug does better than a placebo. Not better than another drug or anything else, better than a placebo, a sugar pill. And so you can do as many of them trials as you want to do. So the odds are, you know, you keep going, maybe you have to hit 100, but you come up with them other two trials. You know, sooner or later.
Well, exactly.
And that's what they did.
And like you say, too, Evelyn, that they don't have to be better than an existing drug. So that means that this new expensive drug that they might approve on the basis of its performance with the placebo might not be better than an existing drug that is already off patent. So it's just pure profiteering. I know a lot of people who were put on SSRIs, which would be like your Paxil, Zoloft, and that type of thing, or your SNRIs, like Effexor. They cannot get off. They know the drug is not doing any good to them, if it ever did, which maybe it didn't, and they cannot get off because these drugs have such they call it discontinuance syndrome, but withdrawal symptoms, electrical jolts in your head, and then all this dopamine and serotonin that you've been goosing with the pill, your body's not going to make it because your body's counting on the drug to make it. And so it's like when they put people on these drugs for so-called depression, they can't get off them. And I've said this for so long now, Evelyn, that what they're calling depression is often life. Okay, like
exactly.
The economy, the job market, your relationship. I mean, there's real reasons to be unhappy, and it doesn't mean you have an SSRI deficiency.
No, no. And that's what I used to say when I had the clinics. You know, I had to screen, by law, I had to screen every person for depression, okay? But the lists weren't like they are now. I mean, it was long lists. But, you know, in 13 years, I never once sent anybody to my staff physician to get on antidepressants or anything. Not once. I mean, people come into treatment, and especially coming into treatment, they have major problems. You know, their marriage might have broke up. They may have lost their home. Addicts and alcoholics lose everything.
Right.
And when they come in, if they were going to be in true depression caused by that, they'd be in it. But they're not. They have to adjust to this and, you know, through treatment, work through this and see how this happened. And that instigates them to not want it to happen again and to stay sober and straight. And so by downplaying all this, you know, and then giving them drugs so they can go out there and then, like I said, with that toxone that people get withdrawing from it, trying to go off it, and they end up going back on it. And in 2011, Harvard did a study, and they said even the ones that they tried to taper off, like they're supposed to use it supposedly for detox person for, you know, several months, I think. But anyhow, within the time they came up with the drug, within just a matter of a week, 91% of the patients had went back to using pain pills or heroin, whatever.
Wow, I totally believe it.
91%. So after they wasted all that money, who knows how long these people were kept on that, it didn't help a bit. And so never hear that about they want to keep you on this for life. But when you add up those costs, my God.
Well, and here's another one for you, Evelyn, that I often, because I'm an activist, you know, against big food and big pharma. I mean, many of us are. And when you're on these happy pills, so to speak, because, you know, you weren't really depressed, but they just want you to, you know, you want to feel better. And what ends up happening is you're no longer an activist. You're just kind of like, you know, apathetic and like, you know, like that cliche, fat, happy, and lazy. You know, but you know, it's like there's reasons to be angry. Okay, if you look at like the world right now, and to just take a pill that you're okay with it. I mean, that is like it's anti-activism, I think.
Well, sure, and like Dr. Peter Bregan has said, that those pills, what they do is alter the part of your brain where you have your emotions, you know, develop and things, and so it makes it numb, and so like you say, when they're on all these drugs, they're just out of it. They can't really get treatment because they don't feel things like empathy and guilt and sadness and everything. They're
well, exactly,
there.
And one of the ultimate examples of that is. You know, you talk about the APA and the DSM. They have actually tried to make grief mental disorder. I mean, if your loved one, your spouse of 20 years or 30 years or whatever dies, you don't have a disease or disorder. You have life, okay? And to give they give pills now for that because, you know, why be sad just because your spouse is dead? I mean, this is life we're talking about, you know?
Right, right. And, you know, in parents raising children, when they fall into this trap, what is that teaching kids? That every time you have a problem, it's a mental illness, and you go and get some drug and take it. You know, I mean, that's just translating addiction to them. You know,
I hadn't even thought of that. You're right. What are you modeling to your kids? You know, there's not always a pill. One of the first people I ever met who was in recovery, he had been drinking and driving, and he ended up being a paraplegic. He still had the use of his arms, but not his legs, you know. And he was spreading the message of, you know, the 12 steps. And he used to say all the time, sometimes there just isn't a pill. You know, there isn't a pill. It's called life, and you walk through it. And not to, you know, make people suffer, but then it gets better, and then you're so happy you did it, you know?
Yeah, right. Well, and you know, too, that, we'll keep talking about this, but I want to put this in here. They got a new mental illness now. I think it was written about in The Guardian over in England. It's for people that like to eat right. Organic foods. Oh, yes, the people that like to eat right. What the heck is it called? I have it on my website.
Oh, my gosh.
I said, I've got it. And they said that won't eat anything to do that has to do with any GMO foods or anything like this, and just likes organic foods and won't eat coffee or salt. And it lists off all these poisonous foods that I know are poisonous now. And said, I've got it, but then I read it, and I said, oh, maybe not. I said, I have a cup of coffee in the morning, and I use salt sometimes. So maybe I don't have it. But yeah, it's like it has a name. It had nervosa at the end, but it has another word to make it the mental disorder for people that just eat right.
Mm-hmm. Wow. No, it you know, when you think of all the things that, you know, it's like overeating, okay? Overeating is really easy to do, you know, because food does taste good and because they put substances in there. And they do it in dog food, too, that really make you, you know, that make it addictive. I get that. But it's not binge eating disorder. It's
and
a
they
sick
promote
culture.
It on TV to eat, 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 eat.
Right.
This is part of it. Yeah. You don't watch TV, so I know you haven't become accustomed to it. But then I watched for it after I learned that. Oh, yes, they do. Horribly. So all these people that are obese.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's. I mean, this. I always say to people when it comes to, you know, eating too much food or taking these drugs that you don't need and they're not good for you, just turn off your TV, and you know, and you won't know what you're missing. Yes, I once heard a joke. Somebody was talking about there was a new car, but he didn't know he needed it because he didn't have a TV. You know, but a lot of this is just, it's whipped up by the, you know, the TV and, you know, the processed food. And we have to have another show sometime on the toxins in these processed foods because they can produce some of this mental unhappiness, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
The stuff that's in there, but can you quickly tell us, I know we're running out of time soon, but I'd like to hear more. Did you meet Senator Grassley?
No. I went to Washington. I met with his staff, but I never met with him. How it was I had wrote so many articles about that teen screen. We talked about that last time.
Yes.
Trying to get in schools and screen every person for mental illness. And they wrote to me and asked me if I would give them some information on that. And I told them then, well, you're way behind. You read articles, I think this was 2009. They read articles from, I think, 2006. I said, we're way beyond that now. I said, what I've been writing about now is the drug in infants and toddlers. I said, I started out with those teen screen articles trying to
get
drug in teenagers. I said, we're down to infants and toddlers now. And so I put the whole timeline together for them.
Oh, my gosh. Mm-hmm. You're right. You're absolutely right.
Drug in kids. Mm-hmm. Regular
and so you met with his staff. Now, did they follow through on anything?
Oh, yeah. And they came out with revealing how much those front groups were getting from the drug companies and things.
Wow.
You know, and Senator Grassley was investing, you know, the doctors that were getting paid under the table from drug companies and doing tests to push these drugs on kids, you know, push antipsychotics and things, drugs on kids for made-up diseases, you know, and things like this, and that got all revealed. And there was a lot of stuff that came out of that, but you know what, Martha? Nothing happened. A few of those psychiatrists got kicked out of being the head of their department at Harvard and down in Atlanta and stuff. But they got hired at other colleges, you know.
You know, I asked somebody who was a pharma insider who had been way up there at Pfizer or someplace, I forget, and I said, why the heck does nothing happen? And he said one reason. they're too big to fail. He said, because nobody else makes the drugs, and you know, we need their drugs, so they won't shut them down. And that's just like Wall Street, you know?
Sure.
And then the other thing that I think would make a difference, I really do, is if the CEOs of these corrupt companies were imprisoned and incarcerated, they would change their tune very quickly, you know?
Well, sure, and, you know, they get sued and they pay these huge amounts of money. I mean, Glasgow got sued there over Paxil for three different things, withdrawal, you know, putting them on these drugs without telling them about withdrawal, for birth defects, which is a big thing, and that got downplayed, too, and that's what I went to Senator Grassley's staff about when I went and met with them. I was lobbying against the Mothers Act, and they were going to be screening all kinds of mothers so they could get them on these drugs, you know.
And their babies are going to end up with birth defects. That's just
and they did.
It's criminal.
Oh, and they did. And so they had them three lawsuits, the birth defects, the withdrawal, and then the suicide. And they ended up paying, I think it was something like $4 billion or something like that. And lawsuit things, and yeah, those birth defects, that upset me so bad because I was reporting on them early, and they kept it up. Well, I reported on the first trial then. It went so bad for them that they went and settled the other one. And I had predicted that in my articles. I said, just wait till they walk into a jury, and they show this little infant that was killed, or harmed, you know. Sure enough, the first trial, they had good experts, and they testified good. They lost so big so fast that they settled all the other ones. But then they go ahead and do this, and they keep prescribing these drugs to pregnant women and stuff.
Well, and they pathologize this, you know, this big thing about maternal depression, and it's worse than the risk to your fetus. You know, there's nothing that pharma won't do. I just did a piece on an asthma drug that's really killing people, and mm-hmm. it doesn't matter. You know, there's nothing but the money, and I think the attitude is, well, we'll build in the settlements into the drug costs. So if a few people
sure.
die, well, you know, that's the price of doing business. It probably is one of the evilest industries in the nation, along
it
with,
is.
Like, Big Chem, you know?
Yeah, it is. I mean, in one group lawsuit alone, there was 600 birth defect cases in that one group of lawsuits.
Oh.
That's how many people they're hurting, you know? And that was, and there was different ones all over the country, but what is it, mass tort, or what is it that they have those all the lawsuits together?
Right,
together.
Those multi-districts. And what, Evelyn, what types of birth defects were they?
Heart, most to do with the heart, because the serotonin affects your heart. I mean, the baby doesn't develop serotonin-making skills until it's old and the mother has body has to supply that to the baby to form organs and things. But what happened was, mother wasn't, because she was on these drugs, and so the baby wasn't getting the serotonin that's planted by nature.
My God.
Yes, and the hearts are not being formed.
These
mm-hmm.
these drug officers, they should be in jail for life for that, for doing that
absolutely.
To people.
And all these suicides, and they knew it from the start. There's my music. Yes, I want you to come back again. We'll talk about it maybe in 2 weeks.
Thank you, Evelyn. I'd love to talk to you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Okay. Bye-bye. Well, thank you, everybody, for stopping in. I hope you learned a little bit today and can stand up against these drug companies and stop this going on. See you next week. Bye.